This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. You've been hearing something special on the show for the past few Mondays. We've teamed up with the podcast Ways and Means to bring you stories of people who are thinking about the issues that shape our world in unconventional ways. Ways and Means is produced by the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, and it highlights the policy research by members of the school's faculty. Over several seasons, the podcast has explored crime, civic engagement, climate change, childhood development, and more. Today, we'll take a look at how these Duke researchers and professors are working to solve three major social issues: end-of-life care, racial discrimination, and access to firearms. Guns is where we start, with journalist Emily Hanford. She's the host of Ways and Means. And before we begin, a note that today's show includes graphic descriptions of gun violence that may not be suitable for young ears. If you prefer to listen to this later, you'll find this story at stateofthings.org. I'll turn it over now to Emily Hanford in the Ways and Means podcast. They'll try to answer the question, how do criminals get access to guns?
Oh, it's not hard to use a gun. All you got to do is pull the trigger.
This is Samuel. He grew up in the Henry Horner Homes, an infamous housing project on the west side of Chicago. He says when he was a kid, it was really easy to get access to guns.
The first time I held a gun, when some guys in the neighborhood would come over there and they would get ready to shoot dices and they had their weapons on them, and I asked them, hey, excuse me, you want me to hold your gun for you until y'all get through? They'd be like, yeah, you can hold them. But then I end up having about 10 guns on them because everybody wanted me to hold their gun at that point.
He was a slight kid with dimples. When he was holding all these guns for the guys playing dice, he was like 11, 12 years old.
I had them all around my waist, and I was sitting on the bench and just sit back like, you know, look at me now, you know? Holding a gun is like that power. Just by having it in your hand, it's power. And it, like, fascinated me, you know, to see the gangsters in the neighborhoods. And, you know, I wanted to be a reflection of them. So I was just flabbergasted to hold a gun, you know.
Pretty soon, Samuel had his own gun.
I'd shoot out the window in a project. I'd go to, like, the 15th floor, and I'd shoot it up toward the sky. It was like getting like a buzzing sound in your ear, like, and after that first shot, you get you another one. Then it became fun at that point.
Before he turned 15, Samuel says he'd shot someone, and Ben shot himself. The easy access to guns when he was a kid ended up changing his life. Samuel agreed to talk with us if we don't use his real name. We'll hear from him, along with Duke professor Philip Cook. Phil is one of the top researchers on the costs and consequences of the widespread availability of guns in America. For one research project, Phil's team conducted interviews with inmates of one of the largest jails in the U.S., the Cook County Jail in Chicago. Researchers went to the jail and asked the inmates, where do you get your guns?
We talked to 99 of them. Most of them were waiting trial. And had a very open-ended conversation about their life with guns, including questions not only about how guns get into their neighborhood and what their experience with guns was, but how specifically did they obtain the last gun that they had.
And this was kind of remarkable because
anything that they told us about how they got a gun was basically going to be a confession of a crime that they committed.
Even so, Phil's team found the men very willing to talk. They were eager, he says, to share their expertise. What his team found is that while policymakers argue about things like background checks for legal gun purchases, criminals, for the most part, are not getting guns through legal means. Most of the young men the researchers talked to couldn't have legally owned a gun even if they wanted to, because they were too young or because they already had criminal records.
Most of them who had a gun said that they had gotten it from somebody they knew.
Phil Cook says that in many urban neighborhoods, kids get guns pretty much the same way an underage kid in any neighborhood in America gets a beer.
Think about, how does an 18-year-old get a beer? The answer is it's somebody they know who maybe is willing to go to the store and buy them a six-pack.
One of the things Phil and his team learned from their research is that guns are not a money-making business for the gangs in Chicago.
They might acquire guns and keep them in a stash and pass them around within the membership, but this was not a business proposition for them.
So even though there are plenty of guns around, you can't just walk into one of these neighborhoods and buy one. And when guys do sell the guns to outsiders, it's only to a certain kind of outsider. Here's Phil talking about one of those interviews at the Cook County Jail.
The interviewer asked, well, would you ever be willing to sell to a stranger if you were selling guns? And the respondent said, yeah, sometimes we're willing to sell to a stranger, but we have to do a background check first. And he used that exact term, which I was very tickled by.
Turns out if you're not in a gang, it could take weeks, even months, to get a gun. Okay, so there are lots of guns on the streets of Chicago. And if you're from the neighborhood, if you're part of a network, you can easily get your hands on one, or 10, like Samuel did before he was even a teenager. But where do all these guns come from in the first place?
On the south side of Chicago, in the city's most dangerous neighborhood of Inglewood, brazen criminals occasionally hit a gangster's jackpot, shiny new guns in transit inside a sitting train car. The ATF says since 2013, more than 150 guns were stolen from freight trains. In one instance, thieves got their hands on more than 100 new Rugers.
This is news footage describing one way guns get into Chicago. Street gangs break into rail yards and rob freight trains full of guns headed to stores and gun shows.
There are many avenues where the guns come from.
This is T.O. Hardiman. He's been trying to stop gun violence in Chicago for years. First with a group called Ceasefire, and now with one called Violence Interrupters. He says he's seen it all when it comes to how criminals get access to guns in his city.
Number one, you have a lot of straw purchasers where people go out and purchase the guns from out of state. Some of these gun shows like in Kentucky, Mississippi, Alabama, and a lot of guys are selling guns out of their trunks before you even get into the gun show. And there's no real background check or screening of the individuals who purchased the guns. So, and they come and people go buy the guns and they bring them back to the city and sell them to young men, you know, like on the south and west sides of Chicago.
And these guns can be really powerful.
Oh, I done had shotguns, I done had handguns. I done had Uzis, I done had carbines.
A carbine, or as others say, a carbine, is a light automatic rifle. Samuel says as a teenage gang member, he had access to a huge variety of guns. When his gang was talking about guns, the code word they used was toy.
Oh, it was a real gun, but we just call them a toy. Or sometimes we might, if we don't say toy, we might give it a name. Go get Dirty Harry or something, or...
But these guns are anything but toys. And while some gun rights advocates argue that it's people who kill people, not guns who kill people, Phil Cook says it's the criminal's choice of weapon that often determines if a victim lives or dies.
There are no drive-by knifings, for example. The 90% plus of officers who are killed with a gun. And all of our presidents who have been assassinated were killed with a gun.
And of course, mass killings.
The type of weapon matters a lot. That's a controversial statement. Believe it or not, it seems like common sense that if you make it easier to kill somebody, that you're going to have more deaths. But for people who resist the idea that the type of weapon matters, they take the view that if the assailant is deprived of a high-powered pistol, for example, then they'll make do with some other type of weapon and do whatever is necessary to see the job done. And that is a myth. It's a belief based on no evidence, and every bit of evidence we have would point in the other direction.
By the time Samuel was 14, he was doing gang security, as he calls it, standing watch with a gun, making sure kids from rival gangs didn't enter his territory. And that's when he got shot for the first time. Samuel and his friend had been standing guard all day, and they'd had a few beers. When they went off duty, they went to Samuel's sister's house to get another beer, and then Samuel's friend reached for his gun.
So we was tussling with the gun. I said, you know what? Let's stop right now before somebody gets shot.
His friend said, okay, sure, I'll stop. But he didn't give the gun back. Samuel went to sit on his bed, and that's when he says his friend began playing Russian roulette.
This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Today, we've teamed up with the podcast Ways and Means, which is produced by Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy and hosted by journalist Emily Hanford. We're listening to an episode that explores how criminals get their guns. A main character in the story is Samuel, a boy from Chicago who has had experiences with guns throughout his young life. He described for our listeners the day his friend started playing Russian roulette when he was in the room. There are moments throughout today's show that will include graphic descriptions of gun violence, which may not be suitable for younger listeners. So if you want to listen later, you can find the program at stateofthings.org. Ways and Means host Emily Hanford returns us now to Samuel's story.
So Samuel, the Chicago teenager we met before, had been with a friend all day doing guard duty, keeping watch with a gun for their neighborhood gang. The two boys went back to Samuel's sister's house to get a beer, and they sat down on Samuel's bed. That's when Samuel says his friend began playing Russian roulette.
And I say, hey, man, don't point that at me. You know, so he pointed it at me. And when I reached to try to grab it from him at that point, he clicked it. And it say, pow, real loud. And when I look up, I had been shot through both of my legs. And I was like, man, homie, you just shot me, you know. So now he started panicking, telling me, oh, no, I done shot you. I done shot you. I asked the paramedic. I never forget. I said, man, I'm about to die right now. And they was like, no, we're going to save you this time.
But it didn't end there. Even though Samuel knew the shooting was an accident, he didn't want to look weak if he didn't retaliate.
If I let this go in the neighborhood where he shot me like that, I felt that it'd be open season where people would just be shooting me at will.
Samuel also wanted his friend to give him some money to cover his medical bills. When he got out of the hospital, he met with his friend and asked him to pay those bills. Samuel's friend refused. After some discussion, the two agreed to meet again the next day to settle the score. The friend thought Samuel would give him a beating or something. Instead, Samuel pulled out his gun.
He was shocked. He saw me when I pulled the gun out, and he was like, the expression on his face was like his eyes got big, and I shot him just like he shot me. Just like I got the holes in my legs, I gave him the same thing. Holes in his leg.
None of this would have happened if these teenagers had not had such easy access to guns. So what to do about this? One thing that's clear from Phil Cook's research is that something needs to be done to stop the flow of guns into urban neighborhoods like the one Samuel grew up in. And lawmakers can do something about this. For example, laws designed to regulate legal gun sales can significantly affect the underground market. After Maryland passed a Firearm and Safety Act in 2013, 41% of surveyed parolees in the state reported that it was more difficult to get a handgun. And a study of over three decades of data on handguns recovered in Boston shows that fewer guns are illegally obtained from states where people are restricted to legally buying just one gun a month. And here's something else that could help. This comes from Phil's research that we heard about earlier on how criminals get guns in urban neighborhoods.
When a gang member or another dangerous person gets picked up that has a gun, there needs to be a lot of questions asked about where that gun came from, what their source is.
Phil Cook argues that if detectives spent time tracking down the history of the gun, law enforcement could tap into the social networks we've been talking about. And rather than simply catching one perp with one gun, cops might ultimately be able to arrest the person who sold that gun, and presumably other guns, into the underground market. Doing this again and again, Phil Cook says law enforcement could begin to chip away at the stream of guns coming into neighborhoods like Samuel's. When he was 20, Samuel was convicted of murdering a rival gang member. He spent his 20s, 30s, and early 40s behind bars. Now he's back in Chicago. Some things have changed. The Henry Horner housing project where he grew up has been demolished. He lives in another neighborhood now. But there are still plenty of guns on the streets. And as powerful as the guns were that he had as a teen, Samuel says the guns on the street are even more powerful today because he hears them all the time.
The guns that they have on the street now, they are so powerful, it makes it back in the day look like child's play, because the stuff that they got out there, it's almost like stuff they would have in the military. They're so powerful, you can hear them like 6 or 7 blocks away.
Samuel says he talks frankly with kids in the neighborhood about how guns changed his life.
And when I tell a story, they listen. But like I tell them, you know, at the end of the day, that's your life. You're responsible for any and everything that you do. So if you put yourself in a situation like I was in, just know you're going to be the one who had to pay the price.
But if law enforcement and policymakers could make some simple changes to block the sheer number of guns entering our cities, kids like the one Samuel talks to might have a much better chance of living lives not marked by violence, either as victims or as perpetrators.
That was journalist Emily Hanford, host of the podcast Ways and Means. It's a production of Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy and highlights faculty research designed to address some of our society's biggest challenges, even one as big as race. This next episode gets into that. We toss around the words white and black all the time in this country. And yet, a look at American history makes one thing clear. The answer to that question, who is white, has changed again and again over time. Ways and Means host Emily Hanford digs into the construction of race and how we got here.
Build that wall. We're going to build that wall. Don't worry about it. We're going to build that wall.
At this Trump rally in Las Vegas, the hall was overflowing with a boisterous crowd that was overwhelmingly white. And then there was Pilar Marrero, a journalist who was born in Venezuela.
I wanted to see it up close, but I didn't want to sit with the press. And I didn't want to be very obvious about the fact that I was media because I wanted just to observe people up close.
She left her press credentials behind and walked out onto the convention center floor where the rally was being held. It was kind of like going undercover.
They were just sharing very freely, you know, like, oh, you know, I think he needs to put up a wall at the border and, you know, we're being overrun with all these illegals. And they were sharing like they would with a friend or someone who's sharing their own ideas.
With her blonde hair and green eyes, Pilar can easily pass for white. She came to the United States from Venezuela about 30 years ago.
Obviously, the vast majority of people there were white. There were some minorities, but they were very few and far in between. And so I kind of felt more secure by just being there and pretending to be white.
It's not the first time she's felt this way.
People don't know quite where to put me. The way I look, light skin, green eyes, lighter hair, makes them think I am an Anglo-American. Right? A white person. But then I speak and I have an accent. Or I speak Spanish, I start speaking Spanish and they go, what?
Pilar doesn't fit neatly into the racial categories in many people's minds. And so people often assume she's white. But assigning people to racial categories, it's something Americans do all the time, often without thinking. We toss around the terms black, Hispanic, and white as if we all agree on what they mean. Yet a look at history shows that ideas about our nation's racial categories, what they are, and who fits into them, are always changing. And in particular, the answer to the question, who is white, has never been simple.
White people as a category has had a strange and circuitous history. The people who are white today were not white yesterday.
That's Duke historian Gunther Peck. He's writing a book about the history of whiteness in America.
The weirdest one who wasn't white were Finns.
Finns. People from Finland. Not so very long ago, the blonde, blue-eyed Finns, who some people might consider the epitome of whiteness, they were actually not considered white.
The coming of the Finn has rocked the Northwoods country. He is today what the red man was 2 centuries ago, the exotic stranger from another world.
This is the introduction to a 1952 book about the folk tales of Finnish Americans, written by a professor at the University of Michigan.
In many ways, the popular myths surrounding the Indian and the Finn run parallel. Both derive from a shadowy Mongolian stock. Just look at their raised cheekbones and slanting eye.
And why, might you ask, would Finnish immigrants not be considered white, blonde as they, many of them are? Well, in this case, in the early 20th century, census takers were told not to record Finnish immigrants as white because they were socialists. They were, almost all of them, fleeing certain types of political persecution, and they were politically far, far to the left.
And the Finns weren't alone. Throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, many immigrants, Italians, Greeks, Hungarians, Bulgarians, they were all classified as non-white.
Today's white people were not yesterday's white people. And the reason the category has changed is because the actual color of white people's skin is not the basis for what white racial identity has been.
In fact, Gunther Peck, the Duke historian, says the very idea that humanity can be divided into races based on skin color, that idea is a fairly modern idea. For instance, back in the day, British nobles would never have said they were members of the white race.
They used race in a different way in the late 17th century. To be a member of a race was to be part of a family, an aristocratic line.
Some of the earliest uses of the phrase white people in U.S. history are in descriptions of indentured servants. Gunther says landowners wanted to distinguish their white servants from their black slaves.
Because the greatest fear in the early 18th century is that whites and blacks will combine. And so it's partly to divide servants and slaves that the language of white rights comes into being.
Even in the early 20th century, the word race was used very differently than it is today.
You would be a member of the Finnish race. You'd be a member of the Hungarian race, of the Jewish race. And so you had hundreds of races. This is where scientific eugenicist thinking became so powerful.
Social scientists at prestigious universities devised a hierarchy, now thoroughly debunked, to rank different national races.
Social scientists measure the slopes of people's foreheads to try to ascertain intelligence.
That's where the term highbrow comes from.
It is horrible social science, but nonetheless was very successful and powerful in creating, what do you know, a single hierarchy of all peoples.
To repeat, these deeply racist ideas have been thoroughly disproved, yet they continue to cast a dark shadow over contemporary American life. Some immigrant groups who were officially considered white still faced racial discrimination. The Irish, for instance. In the eyes of the law and immigration authorities in the 19th century, Irish immigrants were considered white. But that's not how they were viewed by many people. It was common to see signs that said, "Irish need not apply." And worse, some Irish activists pushed for alliances between Irish workers and African Americans.
So then the question becomes, well, what will the Irish do? Will the Irish find common cause with African Americans, or will they treat them with racism? That question was at the heart of a lot of the drama of the 19th century.
In the end, most Irish Americans followed the path of so many other immigrant groups. They merged into the American melting pot. In a generation's time, they went from being victims of racial prejudice to being seen as white.
This is not to say that race has not been an issue in this campaign. At various stages in the campaign, some commentators have deemed me either too black or not black enough.
When Barack Obama was elected president, it was a racial milestone for the country. Obama was celebrated by many as America's first black president, but he is also the country's first biracial president. That fact wasn't lost on Sarah Gaither. Sarah's a psychologist who teaches at Duke. Sarah wondered what effect Obama's re-election might have on racial attitudes. So she surveyed people, black and white, just before and after the 2012 election, and she asked them to describe Obama's race.
Before the election, whites didn't think he was very white, and blacks didn't think he was very black. But 2 weeks after his re-election, we found that whites then thought he was very white, and blacks then thought he was very black.
Nothing actually changed about Obama's identity in less than a month, of course. Yet people's perceptions about his race shifted.
And so what we call this in social psychology is something known as burging, or basking in reflective glory. So when someone from your team wins, you tend to want to claim that team member a lot more strongly than when that team member loses.
Sarah has experienced shifting racial perceptions firsthand. Her mother is white and her father is black. Like Pilar Marrero, the journalist we heard from earlier, Sarah is often mistaken for white. In fact, she's often challenged to prove her racial identity. So she carries around a family photo that shows her white mother, her black father, and her brother. Her brother looks more like her dad.
So he has an African nose, he has black lips, so broader lips. So he looks much more mixed than I do. He gets miscategorized as being black very often. I never really get that experience. He's been pulled over for driving while black. He's been followed around stores for looking black.
Being biracial gives Sarah a different window on whiteness in America, and blackness, too.
I definitely think across my entire life, I've had a number of privileges in being able to pass as white. I'll never be followed in stores. I'll never be pulled over by cops. These kinds of experiences just won't happen to me.
Being biracial has led Sarah to study cross-racial communication and cross-racial perception. One thing that helps, she found, is simple exposure. For instance, she looked at what happens when white college students room with students of another race.
At the end of students' first years, those white students who are living with someone who was not white, so either Asian, black, or Latino, doesn't matter what race, they were able to interact much more positively with a black person they had never met before, and they were also able to discuss issues of affirmative action in a much less biased, much more open manner compared to white students who lived with other white students.
Communication across racial lines. It sounds so simple and non-threatening. Yet it's not, says Duke historian Gunther Peck.
When progress has occurred, it's because there is an alliance between African Americans and other groups that have been marginalized, whether they're immigrants, whether they're working class whites. And when they've come together, there's been genuine economic progress, political expansion of rights. And conversely, in the opposite, it was when rights have been thoroughly racialized, poor whites lose, African Americans lose, our democracy is stunted.
Gunther says focusing on racial divisions helps distract from other divisions. As long as Americans are focused on racial differences, we tend to pay less attention to how deeply divided we are when it comes to income. Martin Luther King spoke about this at the end of his life, Gunther says.
And King was arguing precisely that this poor person's campaign is powerful because it is not just black. It's black, it's poor white. It was Native Americans, Mexican Americans, all coming together to fight poverty. And that's the most dangerous political force and progressive political force in U.S. history.
Census predictions suggest that within 30 years, white people will be a minority. Meanwhile, the number of biracial Americans is growing, Americans like Sarah Gaither. Less is known about how biracial Americans experience race.
Race is a socially constructed category that we importantly constructed. We have made what white is, we have made what black is, and we're slowly making what biracial is or is not.
Pilar Marrero agrees. She says it will be interesting to watch coming generations. In the past, waves of lighter-skinned immigrants, the ones who could, joined the American mainstream by letting go of their ethnic identities. They merged into the famed American melting pot and became white. Now it seems that white may soon be one racial category among many. And with that demographic shift, perhaps what it means to be white in America will change yet again.
Who knows if whiteness will stop being this greatest, this great thing, right? We may not be a melting pot anymore. We may be more of a salad bowl. But there's certain ideas that unite us, right? There's certain aspirations that we all have. And I think that's what continues to make it possible for this country to exist.
That was journalist Pilar Marrero on the podcast Ways and Means. We're collaborating with that show today to bring you stories from their episodes on how researchers at Duke are working to solve social problems. This last story is about the choices we make during one of the most difficult periods of life. Helping a loved one who is facing death can be really daunting. Yet, if we listen more to what the seniors in our life tell us about what they want, we may find some surprises. Ways and Means host Emily Hanford tells us about what the research says.
I remember many conversations with my mom in the last 10 years where she'd say, "Well, I don't know what I want to do, but I really don't want to be a burden." And it's been such a joke because it has been the greatest burden on us imaginable.
This is Heidi Hannipal. Heidi found out her mom, Linda J., was dying from a brain tumor. Heidi took a leave from her job and moved her mom into her busy home on a tree-lined street in Durham, North Carolina. Heidi committed to care for her mom until she passed away, whether that happened in days or weeks or months. It wasn't an easy decision. Heidi and her mom have always had a complicated relationship.
I walked into this thinking, oh gosh, here's this event, and maybe we can do some really good healing from this, all of us. And, you know, we'll hold mom's hand and we'll walk towards the inevitable. But that was not what she wanted.
Heidi and her mom, they handle things differently. For example, one day Heidi heard her mom talking to one of her caregivers.
And I remember her saying to this one nurse, Heidi's doing so much, more than anyone would really want someone to do. And I realized, oh, this isn't what she wants. I'm doing the things that I would do for me, but that wasn't what she wanted.
Heidi says it was unimaginably hard. Everything was just so overwhelming.
Suddenly, everything, her entire life, just became my responsibility. All of her financial burden became mine. And my husband and I were at a point where we were looking at the light at the end of the tunnel of raising four kids and thinking of all the wonderful road trips and crazy fun that we were going to have, and that door just slammed shut.
One of the initial problems was financial. Heidi knew her mom was running out of money. And while she had decent medical insurance and Medicare and even long-term care insurance, Heidi was worried it wasn't enough. For example, Heidi says her mom's long-term care insurance provided $110 a day for a nursing home, but the average daily cost in the area was nearly double that. And since Heidi wasn't sure how long her mom would live, she didn't want her to get in over her head financially. And so pretty soon, Heidi's mom, Linda, was living in Heidi's spare bedroom. And Heidi was determined to make her mom's last days as good as they could be. Figuring out what her mom wanted, though, that was hard. Her mom would not admit she was dying.
She didn't want to process this. She didn't want to think about it. She's a fighter. She wants to live. And she has always lived very, very hard. But she didn't want to talk about the tumor. She just kept saying, I'm going to get better. I'm going to beat this. I'm not ready to die. I have so much work to do. I have so many grandkids to live for. So we never really had a conversation about it. And initially she said this. She said, I don't want any of my friends to know. And no one is allowed to come and visit me. And I just looked at her and I said, that's impossible. And, but I was very careful at first because I was struggling so much with this. What's the balance of giving her what she needs and honoring her as a patient with this horrible diagnosis?
But it's been hard. Heidi feels many people in the system, nurses, physician's assistants, occupational and physical therapists, were almost colluding with her mom. They'd say things like,
when you get stronger and when you get better, this is what you're going to do to get stronger and better. And you've got to do all these exercises so you're getting stronger and better. And everybody was always talking about stronger and better. And no one ever said that it's not going to be an uphill climb. It's a downhill climb with an ending. No one would say that. And she would always throw her hands up when someone new would come into the room and say, don't give me any bad news. Just keep it positive. We're here to keep things positive. And I, you know, well, of course I love hope and positivity, and I think I'm a positive person. But there's also the reality, and no one wanted to touch the reality.
And the reality was this. Linda was not going to get better. And there were a lot of choices to be made. And because her mom wouldn't or couldn't face her diagnosis, Heidi ended up making the choices for her mom, using her best judgment. But Heidi really wanted the two of them to make those decisions together.
I think what I would have liked her to say is, I'm scared because I was scared. I'm scared. I don't know what to do. I don't know where we're going. To just be honest about that, I think, is what I wanted. Instead of what I felt like was we were constantly tiptoeing around this huge beast that sat in the middle of the room.
Don Taylor studies the economics of the end of life at Duke University. He says Heidi and her mom are not alone. 65 million people in the U.S. are caregivers to someone sick, disabled, or elderly. And no matter what your relationship is with your parent, it's really hard to talk about end-of-life issues. Just like Heidi, caretakers often feel they're on their own, without guidance or financial help, figuring everything out from scratch, including what to do and how to pay for it. Medicare, he says, is the system that should help. In the United States, 8 of 10 people are on Medicare when they die.
People are stunned. Oh my gosh, 8 out of 10 people that die are Medicare beneficiaries. So what that means is that Medicare is inherently in the end-of-life business, period. And so that means that that should be the epicenter of deciding how to communicate information to patients.
In 2016, for the first time ever, Medicare began to pay doctors and nurses to talk with patients about end-of-life decisions. Not only when you enroll in Medicare at age 65, but when you most need it, anytime, including when you're really sick. And for many of us, what we want at the end of our life actually changes the closer we get to it. Don Taylor points to a study he did with terminally ill people, where researchers showed them a list of benefits Medicare offers. Then researchers asked the patients a hypothetical question.
And these are patients who are very sick, that they're very ill with cancer. So, and we said, if you couldn't have everything that the Medicare program now pays for, what would you pick? What would be most important?
What the researchers found was a lot of people, between 40 and 50%, didn't choose last-ditch chemo treatments or experimental therapies. They chose care that would make their final days more comfortable.
So here you could think of care like helping an elderly person get in and out of bed, perhaps going and cooking lunch for them and making sure they were okay in the middle of the day.
So just think about that. A huge percentage of people who are staring death in the face, about half of them say if given the choice, they'd really rather have Medicare pay for the little things. They'd like help with their daily needs as their lives are winding down, rather than more expensive treatments intended to prolong life. This is really different from how Medicare operates now.
Basically now the Medicare program, if something's not experimental, it will be covered. And if a doc and a patient decide they both want this treatment to happen, roughly speaking, it will happen.
What he's saying is the big stuff. Medical treatments like x-rays and CAT scans, those are covered. That probably explains why Linda's doctors were more focused on treatment than palliative care. But the kind of care many people say they want is something Don calls high-touch, low-tech. That kind of care is relatively inexpensive, yet it's usually not covered by Medicare unless the patient is in hospice. And hospice, in general, is for those with 6 months or less to live. But for patients like Heidi's mom, Linda, who are not in hospice yet but are very sick, they need long-term care.
And the Medicare program, the biggest hole, so to speak, in the benefit package is long-term care services. And that's just care that helps people deal with the fact that they can no longer do things that most people take for granted, you know, getting in and out of bed, take a bath, put on a shirt, go to the toilet, make a meal. Those types of things.
So this idea, asking people who are dying what they want and designing Medicare options around that, this idea could have tremendous financial implications. Traditionally, policymakers have said, well, there's just not the money for that, because such changes would be seen as adding services to an already giant system. But Don's work shows what dying people want could not only make the person more comfortable, it could actually save the system money because these high-touch, low-tech options actually cost less than what patients often get, expensive treatments in a hospital. The key, says Don Taylor, is both doctors and policymakers need to consider what people want when they are dying.
These people were fully in touch with their mortality and were more in touch with the reality of trying to live another day, another day, another day as best they could. And so, you know, 40-50% of them had gotten to the point where, you know, high touch, low tech services would be likely to help them live a better life tomorrow or today. And so they were the ones ready to have the hard conversation.
Doctors need to be trained for these sensitive conversations, the very kinds of conversations Heidi wanted so much. And that training is not always happening. Don remembers years ago, he was advising a relative who was really sick. On the first couple of doctor's visits, the doctors asked him, "Do you have any questions?"
And so I asked questions like, well, what's the likelihood this is going to work? And I also started asking some questions about cost. I was saying, well, how much will this cost versus that and the probability that it might work? And basically, the doctors were irritated by the questions. And I was then kind of irritated back. I was like, well, you're the one that said, do you have any questions? So, if you know, don't patronize us. If you don't care if we have questions, don't pretend like you do.
Don says he thinks there's a simple reason why the doctors were annoyed. They didn't know the answers. The questions he was asking, likelihood, probability, cost, doctors just aren't trained in that.
We should be consumed with that. We should be consumed with the idea that we sometimes are offering patients therapies that we really, when I say we, I'm talking about the health system, the providers, they don't really know what the cost implications are for the family. They don't really know what the likelihood that something might work might be. They don't know how to communicate uncertainty. And again, part of the reason they don't know how to do it is because it's hard. So it could sound like I'm saying, oh, bad doctors, why don't you just learn how to do this simple? This is really difficult stuff.
So I kind of like to hold Mom's hand. I don't know if you're awake, Mom, but I have a friend here, and she's from Duke.
Heidi Hannipol is sitting at her mother's bedside in a small bedroom off the entryway to her home in Durham, North Carolina. The shades are drawn, Linda's eyes are shut, her breath is coming lightly.
Your story is our story. I guess I hope that you feel that. Know that we were here for you, and Henry was here, Claire was here, Nora and Brenna were all here. We just wanted to give you a place that was peaceful and safe and filled with the love of your friends and your kids. I think you feel that. I'll let you rest, Mom.
Linda J. died a week later, peacefully, in her daughter Heidi's home.
That story comes from the podcast Ways and Means, a production of Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Ways and Means is produced by Carol Jackson, Allison Jones, and Karen Kemp. You'll hear more from the show next Monday at this time. And you can find more about it at waysandmeansshow.org or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And speaking of podcasts, WUNC has a new one that I would love to tell you about before we go. It's called Tested. And it's a daily look at how the COVID-19 crisis is playing out in North Carolina. Dave DeWitt, who you've heard on The State of Things, hosts the podcast. And if you're feeling inundated with information about what to do and what not to do and how to process all of this, it's a really nice way to get digestible bits of information customized for us right here in the Tar Heel State. Check it out at wunc.org/tested or wherever you get your podcasts. We would love if you would subscribe and leave us a review. And one more note about the coronavirus outbreak. We would still love to hear from you about how you are handling everything at this point in time. There are lots of ways to get in touch with us, and we would love to share your story. Leave a message or text at 919-980-5419, or take a moment and fill out our survey. You can find it on our Facebook page. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, and Kaya Findlay. Josie Taris is our intern, and Jenny Lawson is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.